Well, I'm an experimentalist, and many of the people that are participating in the program are theorists. And so I'm going to put a slightly different slant on a lot of things that have been taking place already. And rather than go through and specifically try to introduce the program, what I'm going to do is try to make references to the program throughout the talk, and because that's what I'm most comfortable doing. And so the part of the brain that I work on is a region of cerebral cortex that's been termed motor cortex. And so those of you that have sat in on some of the talks before and are familiar, systems neuroscience and the world of neuroscience in general can be divided sort of into two parts. One is sensory physiology or neurophysiology, and the other is motor neurophysiology. And there tends to be this sort of artificial boundary between the two. And most of what has taken place, with the exception of perhaps one lecture, has been focused on the sensory side. So this, again, is a different slant in a couple of different ways. One is that it's data-centric. Two is that it's the motor side. But again, I'll be making references throughout the entire program, about the entire program throughout the talk. So let's just get started. This if I draw a picture of the brain, okay, and this is a experimentalist picture of the brain. This is the front of the brain. This is the back of the brain, for those of you that aren't familiar with that. You can get too theoretical at a certain point. If you look at the primate brain, there's a wrinkle in the brain called the central sulcus. And they call it the central sulcus because it's somewhere in the middle of the brain. And there's this region of the brain that I'm interested in is right here. It's right in front of the central sulcus, and that's called the motor cortex. And the reason it's called the motor cortex is because about 140 years ago, investigators put electrodes on the brain, passed current in the brain, and what they noticed is that if they put current in the brain, a part of the body would move. And if they put current on a different part of this motor cortex, a different part of the body would move. And so by putting current in the brain, they found that this was related to movement. And there's a reason that this particular region of the brain is related to movement when you put electrical shocks in. And that's because if you look at this region of the brain, it has these giant cells. Okay, these are amongst the largest cells in the brain, in the cortex especially, and these are called BET cells or gigantopyramidalis cells. And they're pyramidally shaped, this being a pyramidal shape, and they have long dendrites. And so that if you look at the cortex as a layered structure, that this goes from the bottom of the cortex all the way to the top. And so when you put a positive current in here, this acts as a dipole. It makes this region inside the cell negative. This part is positive. And it turns out that the part of the cell that's important for generating action potentials is right here. And so when you make this part positive, you raise the membrane potential inside positively. That depolarizes the cell and activates an action potential. Now, action potentials are these pulses. You can think of them as delta functions that fire at different frequencies. And these are the business end of the cell. These are how cells communicate to each other, by firing action potentials. Okay, so it just so happens that this region of the brain has giant pyramidal cells. They're very susceptible to surface-applied positive current. And then also, they have axons. They're one of the, turns out to be several regions of cortex that send axons out to the spinal cord and in a relatively direct way to muscles. Now, it turns out that there are several other regions of cerebral cortex that do that, but this happened to be the most accessible to the people putting stimulation in, and they had this direct pathway. So this combined with these giant cells and this relatively direct pathway to muscles is why people call this motor cortex. Now, if you study physiologically, and as I'm going to get to, motor cortex in a different way by recording neural activity rather than stimulating, you'll get a slightly different picture as to what's going on. But nonetheless, this historical idea that you have electrical stimulation and it's hooked up in a relatively direct way historical point of view as to what motor cortex does, and that's to activate muscles in a point-to-point way. So the idea is you put a pulse of electricity in, you get a muscle contraction. And if you look in textbooks and clinical textbooks that say, what does motor cortex do? They say, well, it activates single muscles. Okay, so more recently now, let's jump to about the 1970s, where people were actually now recording from the cerebral cortex. So let's draw the brain again. And now, instead of stimulating, they put in microelectrodes, and they can record action potential. So they can actually look at neurons as they communicate with other neurons. And what you get then is an action potential. And if you record outside the cell, and you look, they look something like this. Okay, and this is on the order of 300 microvolts. If you have a good one, somewhere between 50 and 300 microvolts. You can look at these potentials, and what you do then is you look at the way, now if we look at time, and let's say I'm going to reach for something, okay? And my task is to start from the middle and reach in this direction, okay? What I do then is I look, now this is time, and I just look at my action potentials. I see one fires here. Here's where my movement starts. Here, and I see a bunch of these action potentials firing. Okay, and now this is movement one. Let's just put this up here. So I have a bunch of cells firing up here. Now, if I move in the opposite direction, and someone has an electrode in my cortex recording the same cell, I'll see that the cell hardly fires at all. Okay, and if I move up here, the cell fires maybe a little less. And over here, it fires a little less. And then if I look over here and over here, okay? So that up here, when I move up here, if I'm listening, I hear this thing ripping. I'll hear like a Geiger counter firing high, at a high rate. If I move it down here, it fires at a low rate. And then in between, it fires at intermediate rates. And so if I was to plot, just look at the discharge rate, just measure some function, count the number of times the action potential fired in a given period of time, for instance, the whole movement, okay? And I was to plot this in a different way, I'd say, okay, it fires a lot over here it fires a little less, over here it hardly fires at all. And so if I was to plot it, maybe I could make a circle like this. It would look like that, okay? Another way to plot this is say, let's look at movement direction, okay, against rate. And now the direction, let's say up and to the right, we'll call that 0 degrees. And then I have plus 45, minus 45. Okay, and if I plot that, I'll get something that looks like a cosine function. Okay, so we call this direction the preferred direction because it's the maximum discharge rate for that cell. Okay, so this is our magic tuning function. Now, this was found initially in the early 80s by the Georgopoulos lab. And I was a postdoc slightly later than that in the same lab. So most of my research is based on this idea of the tuning function and movement direction. Now, notice that this is a different concept than what had gone historically. Instead of saying that what's represented or what the motor cortex does is control single muscles, here we're saying it's related to the direction of movement. Okay, so the parameter now has now switched from individual muscle activations to the direction of movement. Now,
is that direction set by the initial movement, or is that specific to the cell? So if the cell fires, it will always have that preferential.
Right. So this is sort of this is labeling the cell. Okay, so this is a labeled line concept. So this. You can think of this cell always having the same preferred direction, but I can move in any direction, so the cell's going to be active in various ways.
So okay? If it initially went in the opposite direction, it would still have that sort of signal structure?
Yeah, it doesn't matter when I go. Okay, it's locked into that preferred direction. So the interesting thing about this tuning function is that it's wide. It covers all directions. So this would be minus 180 to plus 180. Okay. Now, it turns out that if you look in other parts of the brain, you'll get other tuning functions. For instance, in visual cortex. You know, this was in the 80s, and they knew that well before that, in the visual cortex, the cells, they had tuning functions, and they're oriented to different directions of bars, for instance. And they have more narrow tuning functions. Okay? But it turns out that these wide tuning functions are found throughout the brain. These are, you know, if you actually were looking in the brain and counted the number of different places, most of the parts of the brain, in fact, the entire nervous system, even the peripheral nervous system, primary afferents come in, stretch receptors, touch receptors, they tend to have these very broad tuning functions. Okay? So what does that mean? Well, that means that this individual cell is active not only for its preferred direction, but it changes discharge rate for all directions. Okay, so it's not just the fact that it increases its discharge rate in the preferred direction, it's also interesting that it decreases its discharge rate for other directions. So the concept...
What's the background?
So that's the interesting thing. I was just getting to that. So the idea then is that there's a background rate, say, over here, okay, and if you go opposite the preferred direction, it will drop below the background rate, and if you go in the preferred direction, it will go above the background rate. Okay, so that, again, the idea is that decreases in activity are just as important as increases in activity. And if you look at many people doing modeling or talking about brain function, they only consider increases in activity. But again, you know, for those of anybody that's studying information theory or trying to look how much information is in one of these things, okay, decreases in activity are just as important as increases. Okay, so that's a good concept to remember. Okay, so you can turn this idea of wide tuning around and say, well, what happens to many cells? Okay, what this says is that all the cells, okay, in this region of the brain, in fact, many regions of the brain, are changing their activity for every single movement. Okay, so this brings out another concept that there isn't just a cluster of cells that are active when I move to the right. All the cells change. Some increase, some decrease, but they all change their activity. And so that brings in the concept of populations, in that if you want to try to understand parts of the brain, you need to look at a large population of cells, because they're all involved for every movement. So the last thing I want to draw on the board here is how we came up with a way of looking at this activity across many cells. So let's just say we start at a point, and we have, now this is, we're going to plot cells, we want to represent a directional representation of the different cells. So this cell, it has its preferred direction up here. So I'm going to represent it with a vector in that direction. Now, as I said, if I record another cell for the same movement, let's say I'm moving in this direction, another cell will have a preferred direction, say, orthogonal to that. But we know from the cosine tuning function that it's not going to fire very much. And in fact, if we observe it, we notice that it doesn't fire very much. So it's going to have a short vector. Okay? We're just going to take the magnitude of the vector to represent the discharge rate of the cell. In fact, the way we're going to do it is we're going to take this difference between the background rate and its actual rate that we record. So if we're going opposite the preferred direction, the vector is going to go in the opposite direction. If we're going in the preferred direction, okay, it's going to have a positive vector.
Are you simplifying or are you just looking at motion in the plane?
The initial experiments were in a plane. Later we'll look at three-dimensional space. Okay? So anyway, what you get when you add this up and you look at these guys, and what we're doing now, if we want to take this in information content, we can take these negative vectors and we can flip them over. We'll put a negative sign so that their contribution, the amount of useful information they give us, is just as big as the ones in the preferred direction. So we're going to put them up there like that. And if you look at this, you get something like this. So if you look at many cells, okay, as you move in this direction, you're going to get a vector representation that looks like this. And what we do then is we just take these vectors and take either the sum or the average, it doesn't really matter for our purposes, and we're going to get a resultant vector. And that resultant vector looks like this. We call that the population vector. And that is our prediction of movement direction. Okay, and it turns out that by adding these responses of these individual cells together, we can get a good prediction of movement direction by looking at this neural activity. And this comes from adding these constituent vectors together, vector sum. Okay? So if I want to look at this area of the brain and say, can I predict what direction the guy's about to move? Or someone's looking at my brain, says, what direction is Schwartz going to move right now? Well, if you had these electrodes and you could record these many cells, you could say, ah, the population vector points in this direction. He's about to move in this direction. Okay?
How many cells would you typically need monitoring in this situation? Hundreds or?
If you wanted to do this, okay, I'll show you. Okay? It depends on the assumptions you make. Initially, we thought it would take hundreds of cells to get an accurate prediction. But now, later on in the talk, I'll show you how we actually use this to do this in real time. And it turns out you need very few cells to do this.
The cell is setting its angle relative to what axis?
Well,
gravity or the location of the orientation of the spine?
The coordinate system is the instantaneous direction of the hand. Okay, so it's a hand-centered coordinate system. I'll show you that in a second.
You said you use this to predict in one direction something that's about to move. What's the time delay?
Okay, so if I'm doing this task where I'm just counting the number of spikes over the whole task, and I right, I'll tell you, okay? So now I just start counting these cells. These cells start ticking before the movement begins, okay? And so typically I can get this population vector, it pops, it appears out of the background about 120 milliseconds before the onset of movement. So it's a predictive signal in motor cortex. All right? So these were the early experiments where I just get one vector for the whole movement. Now what I'm going to show you in a second in the movies is that you can actually, if you're drawing like this, or drawing like this, or drawing an oval, you can break these into little pieces and calculate these population vectors instantaneously. Okay, and you can get an instant by instant representation of hand velocity. Okay, so you can actually be much more precise than just this big vector. You can break this into instantaneous vectors. Okay, so let's see what we can do with this. This latency here is actually elastic, and it's very interesting. I'll show you that. That's one of our findings.
So the cells which actually fire in a given direction are sort of correlated in the, spatially correlated. I mean, like this direction would be in a particular location, then a nearby direction is a nearby cell.
So you're asking, is there a topography to the preferred directions in the brain?
Sort
of, well, that's an open question. Okay, some people think that it is. In general, it's not, let's say it's not precisely organized. Okay, it may be loosely organized. Okay, so we can skip these slides. So this shows you from motor cortex the projection. It goes from motor cortex out of the cerebral cortex through the brainstem to the spinal cord. So these are the relatively direct connections from motor cortex. Here's the task I just explained. Here's the tuning function. So again, you can see the activity up here is high. Down here, it shuts down. You can make these tuning functions. So the preferred direction here is here of that cell.
Single extracellular.
This is a single cell, right? When you make these population vectors by adding these clusters together, you get these dotted lines. So these are the old data now. These are about 30 years old, 25 years old. And you can see that these population vectors match the direction of movement very nicely.
Some monkey?
These were recorded from a monkey, right? Okay. So there's a monkey. And what I did when I started on my own is instead of just doing these center out straight movements, I had the monkey do drawing movements because I wanted to look to see what happened to the cell activity on an instant by instant basis. And so this is the way we do it. We have a microdrive up here. It's a little motor that moves an electrode up and down until we find a cell we're interested in, and then we record these individual action potentials.
How do you get the monkey to draw?
That's part of the magic of the business. Actually, what we do is we reward him, okay? And it's a behavioral shaping thing. And so you have him, you know, just move a little bit to a target, and then you keep increasing in the difficulty until he gradually gets it. It takes a month or two, or three or four, sometimes half a year. Okay, so in this experiment, we got the monkey to trace a spiral. And what we did is, instant by instant, we recorded these cells on an instant by instant basis. Now, I should tell you that in these early experiments, I had to record the cells one at a time. So the idea then is that the monkey repeated the task over and over again. Each time I recorded a different cell, but we assumed that the task was identical. Okay? So I get these, I put a vector down in each cell's preferred direction. I weight it by how fast the cell's firing. And then I sum them all together, and I get this yellow vector that's the population vector. And I do this every 20 milliseconds throughout the task. And this is what I get. So he went outside in, inside out. So these are real data from real monkeys, and it shows that I can get a very accurate, instantaneous representation of movement velocity by these. So one thing I didn't tell you, and Dan Moran, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, explained that this vector not only gives you directional information, but its magnitude is proportional to speed. So really what this is a velocity vector. So when I integrate this vector by adding them tip to tail, I can get an accurate trajectory.
This looks much more perfect than a monkey could call a spiral.
Oh, well, the point is, and I'll show you how we get the monkey to do this, okay? Because what there is a template, and the monkey has to keep its finger in the template as it draws, or it doesn't get rewarded, okay? So I'll show you. I mean, that's why it looks as well as it does.
Get a sense of time. Could you show me two points that are separated by 20 milliseconds around that curve? So how often along that curve are you recording?
I don't know if I can stop it that fast. Let's see.
If you can just show me.
The point is that he changes speed, and that's something I'll get to. So in the middle, he's going slowly, where it's highly curved. And at the end, he's going rapidly. But really, they're about this far apart. Okay, that's the scale. There's 100 points in here. Okay, so let's break this apart. Let's look at the vectors, the velocity vectors from the movement, and compare these to the population vector. Okay, so I divide the movement into 100 pieces. Each piece is represented by one of these arrows. It's a velocity vector. And I'm going to compare it to the population vectors. So the first thing you notice is the population vectors start ahead of this. So this was that lag thing that we're talking about. But the interesting thing is if you go and you compare these piece by piece, you'll see that the amount that these lead those changes during the task. Okay? And I'll show you that in a second. But the other thing to notice is basically how nicely these guys match each other. Okay? Now, what I'm going to do is show you the temporal correspondence. So if I plot, and you may recognize this from Dan Moran's talk, if I plot the direction of the population vector, this is the dotted line here, against the direction of the movement vector as I go through time, you'll see that when I start on the outside and I look at the time difference between those two, so that's this distance along here, you'll see that when I start on the outside, the distance is very small, but as I go to the inside, the time lag gets larger. And the opposite happens when I start on the inside and go to the outside. Okay, so there's something about where I am in the spiral that's related to the lag between my prediction lag, how far ahead I can predict what the direction is going to be. And it turns out that if you take the radius of curvature and plot that against the lag, that you get this linear relationship, both for going outside in and inside out. These are the two superimposed upon each other. So there's this interesting relationship about how much I could predict, how far ahead I could predict based on the curvature. Okay, and what's curvature? What's the rate of change of direction? Okay, so this is a sort of an enticing thing. So Here we have this directional processor, motor cortex, and now I'm looking at this system-wide lag. It seems to be related to the rate of change of direction and how well that propagates through the system. So let's, and it turns out that the same thing happens whether I'm looking at spirals or figure eights or ovals. We get the same relationship. And so we have the animal. This, by the way, is an animal drawing a figure eight. This is what we get from the population vector reconstruction trajectory. You can see that the two match pretty nicely. And now we can start looking at a little more detail. So it turns out that there's certain, we call them invariant rules of movement production. And these are also called animate rules. So one of the things that happens is that when I draw something like a figure eight, I tend to draw it, even though it looks continuous, I really draw it in segments. And this comes from study of handwriting. When you look at handwriting, there's certain things, they can break this into things called stroke. Okay, so they look at the strokes in the handwriting. And what these are changes in the kinematics. So you speed up and slow down in certain ways. And these speeding up and slowing down is related to the curvature. So what happens is that when you go around a curve, you slow down. When you go in a straight part, you speed up. You reach a maximum velocity, and then you slow down. So if you look at the changes in slope of the velocity profile, you can break these into segments. And this is a rule of animate movement. Machines don't necessarily have to follow this. So if you're looking at a robot, and you just put some lights on that robot, and the robot walked across the room in the dark, and you just looked at the lights, you could say, that's a robot walking or moving. And if a person did it, you would see a different profile, and you'd recognize that as an animate movement. So these rules have been studied by the psychophysicists and psychologists. And not only do you obey this when you produce a movement, but you recognize this when you view movement. So it's a pretty important concept in movement control.
And is that true for cats and humans and primates?
It's true for anything. That was true. Octopi have the same thing. In fact, in a way that octopus, you know, it's a imagine a hydraulic movement, and they don't have muscles, right? They move hydraulically. But if you study the kinematics of an octopus arm movement, they have the same invariant properties that we do. Okay, so the point here is that if you look at the finger trajectories and you make these into segments, and you look at the neural trajectories derived from motor cortical cells, they have the same segmented properties. Okay, so this segment rule, this invariant property, is present at the level of the motor cortex. There's another law, and this is called the two-thirds power law. So if you plot curvature against angular velocity, that and you try to make a proportionality, you find that the angular velocity is proportional to the curvature to the minus two-thirds power. So if you plot a log-log scale, you can actually get the exponent very nicely. And that's an interesting thing, because it's true for drawing movements, it's true for handwriting, it's true for, again, for animate movements. The interesting thing is, though, is that children below the age of 12 don't have this two-thirds exponent. Their exponent varies all over the place until they get to about the age of 12. So it's not something related necessarily to the biomechanics of movement. It has to do with just basically how you learn to move and how well you move. So again, if you plot this data this way and you look at the actual movement, you get this linear relationship. If you look at our predicted movement, you get the same linear relationship. So again, this two-thirds power law is present at the level of the motor cortex. So centimeters to the minus two-thirds. Okay, so far what I showed you were planar movements. What I want to show you now are some movements where the animal's moving in free space. Again, these are data that are similar to what Dan Moran showed. And so what happens is, and this will give you a little bit better idea of how the experiment is actually carried out. The animal's viewing this virtual image through a stereo monitor in a periscope arrangement. So he sees this cube, he sees these balls, he sees us in three dimensions, okay? So we have a stereo monitor, he has shutters over his eyes, so he sees these in three dimensions. He doesn't see his hand. He just sees this ball that's co-spatial with his hand. Okay, so this is a cursor. It's a ball in three dimensions. He sees these target balls that appear sequentially at the corners of the cube. His goal is to start from the middle of the cube and reach to the corner. Okay, so this is how we get. As we record single cells in his brain, we can find the preferred direction of each cell as he does this task, because he's moving in eight different directions, three dimensions, and we can determine the tuning function in three-dimensional space of these cells. And then what we're going to do is, we're going to have him, while we're recording the same cell, we're going to have him do a different task. We're going to have him draw. In this case, we're going to have him draw an ellipse or an oval. Okay? And this is what he does for his second task. He sees this oval floating in front of him. He has to put the cursor in the oval and move it around and around in the oval. Okay, if he goes outside the oval, he has to start over again. This is what it looks like to the monkey. There's this oval, puts the ball in it. He has to move around and around. And I'm going to show you this movie. And again, if you've seen this before, it was from Dan. Let me just turn the sound on. Okay. So this is the monkey. He starts, disappears. He has to move around and around. Now that noise you hear is a cell that's being recorded. Okay? It's a single cell recorded. It sounds like a Geiger counter. If you look again carefully, here it starts, fires here, shuts down over here. What's happening? Well, this is the preferred direction of the cell. When the animal moves in the preferred direction, it fires at a high rate. When it moves opposite, it shuts down. So as you go around a circle, you can hear the directional sensitivity of the cell. This is what it looks like from us looking at the animal. We're now the ideal observer looking at the animal. This is the cursor position is locked to his wrist right here. There's a little marker on his arm. As he starts to move, you'll see this better. It's kind of hard to see right now. But the point is that you can see that he's not touching anything. He's just waving his hand in space. Okay? Now, this is what an action potential looks like on the oscilloscope. So here's an action potential. This is the one we recorded. You can see some smaller units in the background. We're not paying attention to those. We're just discriminating these spikes. Here's the discriminator pulse right here. And you can see what it looks like. So those are the data that we collect. Now, the interesting thing about this particular unit, and if you were here when Dan talked about it, we recorded that unit for more than 3 months. Okay, so that's highly unusual in our business to be able to record a single unit. Usually you can record a single unit, you know, with these electrodes and the motor drives, maybe an hour if you're lucky. Okay, but we recorded this cell for 3 months. And that's what I'll get to later in the talk, because we developed a new technique where we actually implant electrodes in the brain and they stay there permanently. Okay, so this was recorded from an electrode that was permanently implanted in the brain, and we kept that particular unit for 3 months. Okay, so
can you detect anything associated with learning?
I'll show you something about that later. Okay, unfortunately, when we recorded this cell, the monkey was already well trained, and he didn't really get much better at the task. Okay. Now, so far, I told you that there's something interesting about the curves. Remember that two things happen. One is that the lag between our prediction and our actual movement goes up for the curves, right? So there's something special. It's that lag gets longer at the curves. Also, another associated finding is that you slow down for the curves, okay? And you slow down in a very precise way. It follows that two-thirds power law. So there's something very special about the curves. Now, let's look at the eye movement. So we're going to look at the eye movements that's represented by these asterisks here. These little dots are the hand movement. And so we're going to look at the correspondence between where you look and where you move your hand. Now, you might think that as you're going around like this, that you watch very carefully where your hand is. Because you know that if you come out with this template, you have to start all over again. Okay, so you might think, well, I'm very carefully following what's going on. But as you'll see, that's not what happens. So again, what happens in these tasks is the animal goes around five times. If he goes around five times successfully without going outside this template, he gets a reward. So you start out, you notice the eye movements are all over the place at the beginning, but look what happens when he starts to go. He jumps. So first he jumps to this corner, now he's going to jump to that corner. And notice the relationship. His eyes jump before the hand gets there. And then they stay there until the hand goes past, and then they jump there. So what's going on? Well, your eye has a fovea in the middle. The reason your eye jumps is because this fovea is the really high acuity place where your eye, you do most of your seeing in this little part of the retina that's the fovea. And so in order to get high acuity, you want your fovea to be at points of interest. So these curves are the point of interest. And what you do is you put your eye there so that as the hand gets there, you see it until it leaves, and then you jump to the next curve. Why is that? Why might you think? It turns out that the animal and you doing the same thing, you make all your mistakes at the curves. Okay, so the behaviorally relevant part, the important part, is at the curves. If you're on the straight part, you do fine. Okay, it's when you come to the curves. If you look at people that study subjects in driving simulators, when you drive, where do you look? Okay, as you go, you look at the curve up ahead. You don't look right in front of you, you look at the curve.
If it were a circle instead of ellipse, where would your eyes?
Your eyes then, well, we did that, okay? And what happens is that since the animals are used to drawing these ellipses like that, they make their trajectories, instead of perfectly circular, they make them a little oval. Okay? And so what they do is they tend, although they spread out more, these points are spread out more, they're still sort of concentrated at the corners.
Are the ellipses only line or vertical as well?
Pardon me?
Are the ellipses vertical or horizontal?
Well, we've done it both ways, and you get the same results.
Seems to me there's a correlation of the eye position when they jump, it's not completely horizontal. Also, the circle that they are bending ellipses vertical.
Okay. So here's a density plot of the hand position, okay? So if you just say, where's the hand? Okay, this is a density plot of hand position. You can see the hand tends to spend more time at the corners, okay, because it slows down at the corners. If you look where the eyes go, this is what we get. So here were the eyes. They don't spend any time in the straight parts. They're always at the corners. And there's a little bit, you know, sometimes they go to two places in this particular monkey. Okay, so to wrap this part of the talk up, I know we can talk about information processing, we can have our theories about what we think is important, but from my point of view, what's important is to look at the behavior, look at the constraints in the behavior, and then try to ask why are those constraints in the actual behavior. So one thing that we saw here is this phenomenon related to curvature. You slow down, you have this time lag, you spend time. So the bottom line is that there seems to be more control exerted, whatever that word means, control exerted when you go around a curve. And if you think in terms of a big information processing system, you think of the cortex as being somehow related to direction, you might think, okay, it takes more bits of information to go around a curve than to go straight. And what do I mean by that? Again, this is a little fuzzy concept, but it's a way of thinking about it. If you're going, imagine you're going instant by instant through this trajectory in your direction processor. If you're going straight, you can say, look, I don't need to know very much about what's going on, or I don't need to make many calculations. I just keep doing what I did in the last time step. Okay, so if I'm a filter, I don't need much to make my prediction. Okay, but now if I'm going around a curve, I have to make more calculations. Okay, because direction is changing, I actually have to do something. So you can think that I have to impart bits of information. Now, if you think of the whole system, you have a fixed channel capacity, okay? You can only fit your bits through these channels at a certain rate. If I need a lot of bits, okay, and I can't get them all through, then I have to slow down so I don't make a mistake, okay? So you can think in terms of constraints and how things work, okay, that I may have a system based on those. Okay, so again, maybe one way to think about these constraints, if I'm thinking of a cost function, is in terms of the system's ability to transmit information through its fixed channel capacity. Another way to think about this cost function is that perhaps the brain works to ease the computational load at the same time it ensures behavioral success. Okay. Let's look at this again, or think about what I'm, shift gears a little bit. Now remember, I was drawing population vectors, and I'm a movement guy, so I'm looking at movement. So these are, think of these as a vectorgram for population vectors. Notice that without imparting any words, okay, that he can interpret these population vectors. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is that by looking at these volitional movements, instead of thinking of them as the counter to sensation, that really the way I should be thinking about this is behavioral output. Okay, so I'm taking data in, I'm processing it, I'm acting on my data, I'm making decisions, I'm deciding how I can be successful to interact with my environment. So really what I'm looking at perhaps is part of this behavioral chain, the cyclic. Okay, I see sensation, I move, I change my environment, I sense those changes, okay? So that's one way to think about it.
So in other words, are you saying that there is no place that's summing those vectors?
Yeah, that's a great point. So that gets me back to the workshop issue. You know, we tend to build these models, and then maybe as a theorist or even as an experimentalist interpreting his data, we really believe that these models have some sort of physical implementation. So again, I'm using these population vectors. I'm summing them together in my machine. I'm the ideal observer observing these data. I put them together, and I make a prediction. I say, look, this population vector predicts. And I think, wow, this is a real neural data, so this is really happening. But then you go one step further, and you go, well, is there a node in the brain that's summing all these data together with an output of a population vector? I mean, we're tempted to think that way. Answer is absolutely not. Okay?
Possible is summing them?
Well, why does it have to be summed?
Well, because in the end, it ends up with a directional motion.
Okay.
At some point, it might be at the end. Muscle.
Right. Well, it takes many muscles to move the arm across the many joints. Okay, so you're right. In a sense, it has to happen. Okay, but in another sense, it's really not being all put together until you make the actual movement. Okay?
Well, that's a question. Is it a definitive answer? I mean, is it summed here? Or
what good would the sum do if it was here? How would it get translated into there?
Well, it might be, if I was designing a computer, I'd do that. It would be simpler. I wouldn't have to transmit all that information, just the sum.
But you'd have to send it all out to all these muscles, right? You'd have to find some way to, you could convolute it into one vector and then you put it back out to all the muscles.
So
all the votes are counted or miscounted in local ballot offices before this sense of
that's been a really difficult part and a controversial part of what we've been doing. So another way of looking at that is that we're saying, look, there, in the motor cortex, there's this movement representation. So you can imagine that you have a coordinate frame in terms of movement. In our case, it's hand velocity, so the coordinate system is centered on the hand. And we know that, in order to move the hand, you have to move the muscles, you have to change joint angles, and you could think that somehow you have to do what we call inverse dynamics or inverse kinematics, where you go from a kinematic representation to a representation of joint angles and muscles, okay? And that you have, somehow you go through one box, you go through a transformation to another box, and the math is, as Dan showed, gets incredibly complex, okay? But you say, look, the brain has to do this. And right, the brain does ultimately have to do that. But the question is, does it do it piecewise in boxes, or does it play some tricks to really simplify the problem? Okay, because all the brain cares about is whether or not you move correctly. Okay, so that's an interesting issue.
Can you study some of that during the learning process? I mean, if you monitor as they're learning this process,
yes,
you would see, I would think, some of that decomposition.
Yes, you can. Okay. All right, so again, I had this quote up here from Melville talking about looking at Captain Ahab as he's pacing the deck. And it says here, "Did you fixedly gaze too upon the ribbed and dented brow? There also you would see still strange footprints, the footprints of his one unsleeping, ever-pacing thought." And then he talks about him first at the binnacle, or first at the mainmast, then at the binnacle. You could almost see that thought turn in him as he turned and pace in him as he paced, so completely possessing him indeed that it all but seemed the inward mold of every outer movement. So again, this idea that our thoughts are represented as movements. Okay, the only way you know how I or think or what I'm thinking, if I'm thinking, is by the way I move or speak, okay? I have to act on my environment. Okay, so again, the idea then that there's a higher level set of processing going on in this motor system. There's both things going on. You have many cells projecting to a single muscle, and you have many cells projecting to multiple muscles. Okay? Single cell doesn't go to a single muscle. Okay? So anyway, let's take this concept. You know, again, I'm going to be a little provocative here. And being in a very, very small minority of people in this field that study the motor system, we have to look at all these guys studying the visual system, and they lay claim to the idea of perception, attention, all that kind of thing is going on in the visual system. But again, what I'm trying to get to is that you see this ramified throughout the entire system, even in the motor system. And so if this is the case, then I can study perception as a motor person. And the way I do that, okay, is by looking at what I call motor illusions. Okay, so I'm sure you all familiar with visual illusions, where you know you play tricks, you think you see something, but in reality it doesn't really happen. Well, a motor illusion is I can get you to move in a way that's different than you actually moved. Okay? And the way I do that is with my virtual reality machine. Okay? Because when you're moving in this virtual reality, I can make you see something. And you think you're doing that, but you're really not doing it. Now, remember what's happening, okay, in this task. The animal puts the ball in this virtual object and traces it around. He doesn't see his hand. I control what he sees. Okay, I control the cursor. I'm the ideal observer. I can mess around with that. Okay. And what I do precisely is that as he's going around, okay, he goes around, remember he goes around five times, but the third time he goes around, I change the gain between the hand and the cursor. In fact, what I do is I increase the horizontal gain by a factor of 1.8, which happens to be the eccentricity of this object. And by doing that, in order to keep this in the object, he actually has to move less. And he moves less in just these parts, okay? And so what happens is he ends up drawing a circle. And when I say he, we did this with human subjects, okay, to start out with, to see what happens. And the thing is, if you change this gain gradually, you start going like this, okay, and at this point I change the gain, and you start like that. At the end, you start drawing a circle, but you don't know you draw a circle. If I ask you, and I'll show you the data from this, what you drew, you say, I just drew five ovals. You don't realize that your hand's moving in a circle. So now what I've done is I've dissociated your actual movement from your perceived movement. And I can study perception in the motor system.
But then the visual feedback is not the only feedback that we're getting.
So. Right, but it turns out that the visual feedback overrides anything else. Okay? In fact, even your memory, it overrides your memory, and I'll show you that. Okay? So again, here's what the task is. Okay? If you look at the hand path, what the hand does, the hand starts out moving in the oval. I go through the 1.8. The hand ends up moving in a circle. What you see on the cursor is you start out going like this, and I change the gain so that visually you see the same thing as what you started out with.
How do you see what
Pardon me? Well, I call it a motor illusion, okay? So you're sensing here, right? Right? It's based on your perception of movement instead of your perception of sensation. Okay? Because the question I'm asking the subject is, how did you move?
Does he slow down on the virtual currency?
Sort of, okay? Okay. So what I did first, these are from the human data. And since I'm claiming this to be perception, I have to actually have some kind of way of measuring perception. And you can't do that in a monkey. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. You can't ask a monkey what they are perceiving. You can ask the question, did the monkey perceive something different? Yes or no. But you can't ask the monkey what they were perceiving. Okay? And so these are human experiments.
But you weren't recording cells.
Pardon me?
You weren't taking electrodes.
In the humans. No. So this is sort of this is a kind of a long history of behaving monkey things, but a lot of times what you do is you do psychophysics in humans, and then you do the same experiment in monkeys with the idea that the neural substrate is going to be similar. Okay? So what we did here is we had subjects just draw a circle. Okay, in this VR environment, they're drawing in the template, and they just draw the circle, and we don't play any tricks on them. They draw the circle, and then we say, okay, give them in the dark, okay, no visual, no display. They're just like you have your eyes closed. Draw a circle, okay. And what we do is we measure the eccentricity. So it's the horizontal axis divided by the vertical axis. And for a circle, that's one. Okay, so these are the actual five trials where they actually drew it. Here's their report. This is what they drew in the dark. You can see it's a little bit more eccentric than the actual one, but it's close. Okay, and then what we did is we said, okay, we're going to play a trick. You're going to start out drawing a circle, and then we're going to change the gain so that you end up drawing an oval. Okay, so here, the subject's drawing a circle, and then we change the gain. Now, in this case, we lower the gain, so you end up drawing an oval instead of a circle. And this is what you draw with your hand. But now I say, what did you perceive? What was it that you just finished drawing? And they all reported that they drew a circle. Okay, so whatever they see on the screen happening is what they report. Okay, now if I do the opposite, where you start out drawing an oval, you report that you draw an oval. Now, here's the task that we studied in the monkey, where they started drawing an oval, we changed the gain, they end up drawing a circle. We said, what did you perceive that you just drew? And they said, I just perceived that I drew an oval. Okay? So this happens. Now you might think this is a real acid test, because imagine they're doing this in the dark. You say, what are you remembering? Are you remembering what you felt you drew? Or are you remembering what you saw that you drew? Okay? And so here we're saying, okay, it's what they saw that they drew. Even though when they repeat it, they're doing it without vision. So that's pretty cool result. Okay, and again, here's just looking at what happens. So in one set of circumstance, okay, the illusory circle matches the actual circle, and the illusory oval matches the actual oval. So that just shows that our illusion works, okay?
So did you say that you had the person do this illusory whatever it was?
Huh? No, so I said draw, so the report. Okay, I didn't just ask them what they thought they did. I asked them to draw what they thought they just did. Okay?
They
always drew what they saw, even though they didn't actually draw that during the test case. Okay? All right, so. Okay, I'm making claim, again, that I'm studying perception. And this now is based on the idea that this visual input is very important because their perception is based on what they see. So how does visual signals propagate through the system to get to the motor system? Okay, so here, I'm drawing these boxes. Okay, I don't like boxes, but they're good for illusions or for illustration. And Freudian slip. Okay, so you can imagine that the input comes into primary visual cortex and then goes through many different stations through the brain until it gets to motor cortex. And there's a classical dissociation between a dorsal pathway and the visual processing stream, which looks at motion, and a ventral pathway, which looks at object. You may have heard of this idea of grandmother cells. Okay, if you flash an image of your grandmother, there's a certain particular cell that lights up. It's an object recognition cell. That would be down here in the ventral pathway. Okay. So anyway, here's the pathway. They come and there's ways that they can converge. There's arrows to each pathway. They eventually get to motor cortex. But what I chose to look at were these regions premotor cortex that are right before the motor cortex. So I'm going to look at primary motor cortex and premotor cortex. And my idea then is to say, what do I see in these places? Do I see the illusion, what you think you're drawing, or what you're actually drawing in these different places? Okay, so that's my question. I want to nail down this idea of perception. Now, the other thing that's implicit in here is that when we draw boxes, we tend to think that, okay, this is a box, so this must be different from this box. And this box must be different from this box, otherwise we wouldn't put it in a box. But look at the technique I'm using. I'm assuming that in all these different areas, the cells behave the same way. They have cosine tuning, they're related to direction, they have the same sort of shape. I can do population vectors. So they're speaking the same language. Okay? But what I'm asking for, I'm using that population algorithm as a tool to try to understand something else. Okay, so again, you know, I'm not so concerned about is it a population vector, isn't a population vector, but as an experimentalist, I want to use this as a tool to try to understand some other function. Okay. So what are the results? Oh, these are the two different areas I recorded from. This is the ventral premotor cortex. This is the primary motor cortex. These little dots mark where in the brain I put my electrode. Okay, so let's start out. Here's the first cycle. I'm recording primary motor cortex. The red is my neural signal. It's my neural trajectory, what I get from the neural activity. The blue is the actual trajectory. And there's a green trajectory in there that you can't see, but that's the path of the cursor. Okay, so I haven't turned my illusion on yet. The neural trajectory matches perfectly with the hand trajectory. Second cycle, same thing. I haven't turned my illusion on yet. They overlap precisely. Third cycle, I'm just beginning to turn my illusion on, right about here. You see a little bit of difference, but they still match pretty well. Now, the fourth cycle, the illusion is even larger. I'm increasing my gain. Now you can see a differentiation between the green, the red, and the blue, because the cursor is now moving differently than the hand trajectory. And finally, in cycle five here, you see what's going on. The red and the blue match, and the green is different. So what does that mean? In motor cortex, the signal matches the hand. Okay? Whatever the hand does, this motor cortex matches the hand trajectory, which is different than what's on the screen. Now let's look at ventral premotor. Again, before the illusion turns on, everything matches very nicely. And if you were just doing the experiment without the illusion and you said, is there a difference between motor cortex and ventral premotor cortex? You'd say, no, look, you get the same thing. Okay? So again, these structures are very much the same. Now I turn this on, start the illusion, you can start to see these things dissociate. They dissociate a little bit more. And finally, at the end, you can see what happens. The neural trajectory matches the vision. Okay? So even though these two structures are connected directly to each other, okay, they're representing different parts of the task. Okay, so I can then dissociate the perceived movement from the actual movement and assign it to different parts of the cortex.
Question. You changed the gain over here continuously. Did you try to change it discontinuously?
No, it's the same for cycles 1 through 2, and then halfway through 3 it starts to change. Okay? And then by the end it changes continuously, or it's changed all the way. Okay? And the reason we did that is because if you do it too abruptly, first of all, you make mistakes all the time because something changed. Second of all, it's really recognizable. Okay. All right. So again, if you just look at the measures of eccentricity, you can see that the hand movement and the neural trajectory match very well during the illusion of the motor cortex. And over here, the neural trajectory, the eccentricity matches that statistically well of the visual trajectory.
What's happened to the recall?
Pardon me?
Recall, that is the last one.
The recall?
The recall, what happens to the trajectory? The motion, you do the recall.
With the report, in the report.
Oh, there's no report.
There's no report here. This, these are the monkey data.
You didn't ask the monkeys.
No, yeah. No. See, the trouble is, in order to get the monkey to do it, to do something like that, you'd have to reward him. And then you have to choose what you're going to reward him for doing. So you're determining what's correct and what isn't correct. Okay? It's a problem. Okay, I just want to briefly mention this. So again, we talked about lag before, and we can look at lag both on the population level that I showed you before and on the lag of individual cells. Now, how did we do this? Well, remember, this tuning function, normally you'd say we want to go from actual trajectory, or from a neural activity to a prediction of movement trajectory. But for this purpose, we're actually going backwards. We're saying, look, what was the instantaneous movement of the hand? And then we go through the tuning function and say, what should the discharge rate be? Okay, so we can get what I call a predicted discharge rate from hand trajectory. So that's the solid line here. And then you look at the actual discharge rate of the cell, and you get this. And so this difference, then, is a measure of the lag between the execution of the movement and the coding for that movement on a single cell. And in motor cortex, you can see that it comes, in this example of a motor cortical cell, you can see that the actual comes before. So the neural signal is predictive of the hand movement. In ventral premotor, though, in this example, look what happens, the opposite. Okay, the hand movement comes before the neural activity. So what might that mean? Well, that might mean that this is sensory driven, perhaps from the vision. Okay, remember, if you look at that chart, ventral premotor gets a big input from the visual part of the brain. Okay, so you might think that this is looking at the visual activity. And in fact, if you look at a histogram of these lags, you see that there's a predominance, okay, of those feedback cells over here. But there's also a fair number of feed-forward cell, predictive cells over here. In motor cortex, you see there's a bias this way. Okay. Now, it'd be interesting, it's tempting to divide this in half and look at these two and say, look, maybe the ones that are feedback are the ones that are related to the perception, and the ones that are feed-forward are the ones that are related to the actual hand control. Okay. And how do those vary, and how do they interact? So perhaps the cells in ventral premotor cortex that are predictive are the ones that go to motor cortex. And I'm not going to tell you the end of that story yet because we're still working on it, but that's something we're going to be working on. And there's some preliminary data. I'm going to skip to that. Okay, so far, and it's been a long, I know it's been a little complicated, and now I'm going to get to a different part of the talk, and that's the idea that I hope I've convinced you that this motor part can be very well related to perception. It has a lot of higher order interesting features, that we can extract things in a very precise way that involves psychophysics and cognitive parts of your behavior. Now what I want to show is the idea that if we can really predict this well, okay, if we are an ideal observer and we think we really understand or have some idea of what's going on, we ought to be able to actually use this activity to predict movement and in an instantaneous basis, okay? Rather than record these cells one at a time, if I can record a population, process this in real time, I should be able to predict a movement and actually use it, have a subject use this to make a virtual movement or move a machine or move a robot arm, okay? And that's this idea of prosthetics. You know, you can imagine a person that can't move. Well, we understand how your brain would like your arm to move. We can complete the circuit for you, okay, by replacing your parts. And that's what we're doing here. So now we're putting our money where our mouth is, or NIH is doing that for us. So the idea then is we have to record many cells simultaneously. We started out by recording with microwires. These are 50 micron wires just cut with a pair of scissors. They're insulated with Teflon in this case, and you can put these in arrays and put these in the brain and hope that they'll work, and sometimes they do. And you can record numbers of cells simultaneously. Okay, More recently, we've gone to silicon technology. These are produced by the University of Michigan. So these are very small micro daggers with recording sites on each shank. This is the back of a penny, so you get an idea of the scale. This is a column of the Lincoln Memorial on the back of a penny. So these are very small. These recording sites are 300 or 400 microns apart. And I'll show you the arrangement of the electrode. So it looks like this. This particular arrangement is a pitchfork with four shanks. Each shank has four recording sites. This is what it looks like, high magnification. So we can put in many of these in the brain. So here's a picture of a surgery that we've done. The biggest part of these things are the connectors. They're huge compared to the electrode. So here's the ribbon of an electrode coming down. There's an end of that is a little shank. This hole that we made in the skull to insert this is the size of a quarter. Okay, so you can see how small this is. There's seven of these. Each of these has 16 electrodes, so I guess that comes out to 112 recording sites, all in motor cortex. So you get an idea of what we're doing. And here's an example of from one electrode of the kind of signal we get. I'll show you. Okay, so here's 16 channels recorded simultaneously. You can see these action potentials. They're fairly good size. So you can see these are action potentials that will pick off on each channel. We can process this in real time, and we can make population vectors in real time. Okay, so what I'm going to do is give you sort of a historical count of our work. And this is going to start from about, now it's almost 10 years ago when we started this. We started with the microwires and we progressed through and to a better and better technology. When we first started, we just had a monkey working in a room pushing buttons. Okay, so these buttons were arranged at the corners of a cube. He's working in three-dimensional space and we were having him do this center out task. Remember those I showed you in virtual reality, starts from the middle, reaches the cube, eight different directions. We recorded this activity simultaneously, processed it. Every 20 milliseconds, we got an answer. We said the population vector is pointing in this direction. And then in the next room, we had a robot arm, and we said, look, we're going to feed that output to the robot arm. Monkey has no idea the robot arm's even there. All the monkey cares about is pushing these buttons. Okay? And we just wanted to see how we could do. Now, if you look closely, you see that this arm moves before the hand does. Why is it? Why does the robot arm move before the monkey's hand?
Decrease the lag to zero.
Yeah, so we're processing this in 20 milliseconds. Normally, remember, it takes 120 milliseconds. So we can actually beat the monkey. An old story, the British investigator, I can't remember his name, was using EEG. This was 20, 30 years ago from a subject. And he was just looking very crudely as yes or no answer based on some feature EEG. And he hooked us up and he had this guy give a slide projector talk, you know, in the old days when you push the button and the slide would go. And he used this it was probably a P300 wave on the surface of the skull to trigger the slide projector. And at some point, you know, the guy's pushing the button, and all of a sudden, instead of him pushing the button, it's triggered on this P300, which is faster than he can actually do it. And the slide would change, and the subject wouldn't know what's happening. Something's wrong. So he starts pushing the button harder and harder and turning into this big feedback mess. But it was a very interesting example of what you can do. The point is that this idea is not new. Okay, so the important point here is that when we started out, the monkey's pushing these buttons, we're recording the activity from the monkey. We have this robot in the next room. The monkey doesn't even know it's there. This is open loop. The monkey has no feedback about what it's trying to do. So what we did is we wanted to make this a closed loop situation, so we used our virtual reality. And again, the monkey sees these things moving. He doesn't see his hand. He just sees the representation. That representation is controlled by us. And so what we can do is we can start the monkey moving his hand, okay, and the cursor is hooked up to his hand, and then at some point we switch the control of the cursor from his hand, from tracking his hand, to his brain signal. And again, this is, we'll start out, this is old work now. So what you'll see here is this is the target, this is the cursor position. We superimpose this on a mover's of his hand. So normally he sees this straight ahead. We had to rotate everything so it would match up. So that it doesn't match exactly, but you get the idea. Okay, so this is just hand controls. Normally what he does, he reaches for these targets. Okay, right there, we switch to brain control. And notice that he still keeps moving his hand. Okay, maybe he moves it a little differently because it doesn't work perfectly. There he didn't move it. Okay, you can imagine if we had perfect control so that we were pulling the signal perfectly and processing it, the subject would never know, okay, that we were doing it. He would just keep thinking that he's using this based on hand control. Okay. Now, as we got better and better, we started making it more and more difficult for the monkey. What we did is we tied the arms down so the animal couldn't move at all. And we had to move these objects just by thinking about it, so he knew that he wasn't moving his hands. Okay? And this is the kind of performance. So this is in 3D. There's targets to the back. We put new targets in that he'd never seen before. Some are straight out, some are straight in. Okay, and he can move almost as well as when he moves his own hand, just by thinking about these. And the point here is that this is an unedited movie. This goes on, we took about 10 minutes for the movie. He can do this for half hour, 45 minutes, with hardly missing anything. Okay, so we can get extremely good performance. Notice that he can go out, he can stop, he can turn around, he can hold it there. It's just like natural movement. No, the hands are tied down, and after a day or so, there's no more muscle activity. Okay, so we recorded muscle activity. He's completely relaxed.
Can you tell that you're missing certain neurons and you speak back to, like, is there bias in one direction or the other?
Oh, yeah. So we have a very limited number. So we're doing this with, this was probably 50 or 60 neurons. Okay, and when you take a sample that small, it's going to be biased. You're not going to get all the preferred directions. Some of the cells are going to be very poorly modulated. Some are modulated not at all. We just take everything we get. What happens, and I'll show you, is that the monkey, because it's closed loop, the monkey learns to change his neural activity. Okay, he gets better and better. He fits the algorithm that we impose on. We assume it's cosine tuned. Sometimes when you start out, the cells aren't very cosine tuned. They get better and better. Okay, and by the end, after a couple months, they're very well cosine related, okay? Because we're imposing that. Okay, one thing we don't pick is the preferred direction, and I'll show you that in a second here. So if you look over days, okay, the performance, now the performance, what we did is we kept him working at 70%, at least 70% success rate, and as he got better and better, we made the ball smaller and smaller. So here's a target radius over days, and you can see that he gets better and better. And that's because he's regulating his neural activity. He's learning through biofeedback to regulate his neural activity and to make it more cosine-like. Okay, now as I said, we don't regulate the preferred direction. We actually try to find the preferred, estimate the preferred direction. And the way we initially did this is we had him do the task by moving his hand, and we said, what's the preferred direction of the cell? And then we use that to make the population vector. It turned out we didn't do very well. What happened is we tie his hands down and we say, we think the preferred direction is the same. Let's use those preferred directions to make our population vector when the hands are tied down. And we found that the monkey didn't do very well. And then we said, well, maybe what we ought to do is re-estimate the preferred directions once the hands are tied down. And we did that. And what we found is that all the preferred directions had changed. Okay? So when you tie the hands down, all of a sudden, the preferred directions change. Now, here's a tuning function of a cell in three-dimensional space. Remember, I showed you before, if I was going to plot it out in a Cartesian space, and there's a planar movement, it would look like a circle. Okay, and you can think of that as a slice through three-dimensional space. If I do in three dimensions, it's kind of this elongated ball. This is what it looks like. Here's a little dimple. That's the anti-preferred direction. Preferred direction now, this is a cube. is pointing down and into the screen. What happens, this was calculated from the hand movement of a single cell. This is what happens when you tie the hands down, and okay, the preferred direction changes. If you look at the whole population, again, this is 50 or 60 cells are recorded simultaneously, and you look to see what happens to all of them. Okay, so the point I'm just trying to illustrate here is that it's this boiling motion. There's no global rotation of preferred directions. They all change independently and at random. Okay? So the way we do it is we put the target up there, and we assume that the animal's trying to get to the target. Okay, and so then we look at that and we say, how did the discharge rate change?
So this is still during the time where he has some isometric muscle activity against the constraint?
No, there's nothing.
This is after the
there's no, arms totally relaxed.
And this is repeatable, so that he always gets the same preferred direction.
Ah, good question. Okay, so anyway, I'll get to that in one slide, okay? This is what it looks like. The stars are where the hand preferred directions are. The end of the non-star side is where the preferred directions end up. And you can see that they're all over the place. But the interesting thing is, are they consistent from day to day? So we can record these cells, the same cells, for multiple days. And we can say, what happens? And this is the X, Y, and Z component of the preferred direction. Here's the change in preferred direction on day 2 versus the preferred change in preferred direction on day 1. And you can see, you get this nice linear relationship. They change consistently on subsequent days, okay? So the change in preferred direction on day 1 is the same as the preferred direction, change in preferred direction on day 2. So although they change randomly, they change the same way from day to day. Okay, so the bottom line is that when we're doing this, we have to calculate the preferred direction in the context in which the animal is going to use this thing. Okay. If you have a global change in context, like tying the hands down, not using any muscle activity versus natural movement, okay, you have a different preferred direction. You know, we don't understand, we really don't understand this very well. But another way of thinking about this is that normally when you move, a given cell is one of billions that are contributing to the movement. When I use this brain control, it's only one of 60. Okay, so all of a sudden its importance goes changes significantly in the task.
Maybe just because the whole concept of preferred direction of the brain has region is not level one.
Well, I wouldn't say it that way, okay? It has to be a valid concept because those are my assumptions and I get it to work. Okay? So that's the neat thing about doing this. Well, I mean, you can never get away from that argument, right? You can always say that there's some hidden thing that's different than what you're assuming, okay? And I can't argue with that. All I can say is that this is our best guess as to how it works. We put those assumptions into place, and sure enough, okay, the animal could do this. Oh, so there are other, right? So there are other algorithms you can use besides population vectors and preferred directions. Valerie has a nice implementation that she's used with using a particle filter, okay, to get this to work. So using an adaptive filter, nonlinear Kalman filter, is probably going to work just fine. We don't know how well the monkey's going to learn this task. So the important thing in this task is that the monkey somehow learns that we're imposing cosine function, and he can make those cells more cosine too.
If I can make a comment and be related to what Ely's saying, you know, in fairness, people like in Nicoletti's lab have used different algorithms. What Ely said, it's an algorithm that relates neural activity to hand motion.
Uh-huh.
And essentially what you do is you substitute the actual hand motion by your algorithm.
Uh-huh.
And people have used other algorithms which do not involve preferred directions and population vectors.
That's right.
And they work equally well.
Well,
so the fact that this works, I don't say, tells you that the correct algorithm for transforming neural activity into motion is the idea of the four directions and the population vector.
That's right. It's not the idea, but what does it? But you have to go a little bit farther back. I wouldn't disagree with that. Okay, but you have to go a little farther back. All the algorithms are based on the idea that you have basically some sort of broad tuning. That there's a tuning function, okay, and that you can add these responses together linearly. People have looked at nonlinear methods of doing this, and it comes out to be just about as well as linear methods. So the general idea that you have many cells simultaneously active, and they tend to have some sort of unimodal tuning function, okay, and you know that they go together, they're related to direction of movement. That seems to be essential. Okay, it's part of all these things. So it doesn't matter, the exact algorithm used probably doesn't matter, but it has to have these basic features.
Is there eye-to-eye movement component in those responses of those cells?
Pardon me?
Eye movement components. Is eye movement somehow reflected on the...
In these parts of the brain that we record from, eye movement probably doesn't play a factor. Okay. Let me just, I got one or two more movies, okay, to show you because they're cool. So instead of working directly only in VR, we can actually go and hook this up to a robot. So the way it works here is that the brain signal goes to the robot, we track the robot arm, and that's the cursor that moves. So the animal, to the animal, it looks like this, the same thing, but he's really controlling a robot. That's here. So he's doing that. So if the robot moved perfectly, the animal would never know the difference. But the animal, the robot doesn't move perfectly, so watch what happens. So there, it has stiction, and the animal has to fight it, but he can get it down. Okay? Okay. And now what we'd really like to do is have the subject view the robot directly and use the robot as a tool. It's a very difficult thing to get monkeys to do. They don't understand tool use. They don't like having this big machine coming at their face. They don't like change in general. But you can entice them if you give them a good, big enough reward. And so what we did initially is we used this really high-tech device. It's a clothespin at the end of the robot arm. We put a big juicy orange in it and then had the monkey bring it to his face. So here you see, this is actually a colleague of mine at Arizona State, Steve Helms-Tillery, is loading that. And you can see that he may not like it, but he can get it to come to his face.
So he's controlling the robot.
Yeah, he's controlling the robot. You can see this robot control is not so good. You see how jerky it is? Then also notice that...
He's actually trying to do something with his hand.
Well, he's trying to get his face... So you'll see him struggle a little bit because he's lifting his head up to get to the orange. So I'm going to show you something a little bit more sophisticated now. So what we've done is we have a new arm. It's anthropomorphic. It has 3 degrees of freedom at the shoulder. It has an elbow joint. It has this gripper at the end. We've oriented it so that it's at the same, the shoulder joint's located at the same proximal position as the monkey's own arm. What we have him doing is the arm is going to reach for the piece of orange. So that's under computer control. The monkey's not using his brain control yet. That's coming soon to reach the orange. What happens is once it's grasped, this fork moves out of the way, and then the animal has to bring it to his mouth. And that's done under brain control.
And he can control how many joints? He can control every single one of the joints.
These are 4 degrees of freedom. What his brain signals is the endpoint control. Oh. We have to go through an inverse kinematic routine to pick the joint angles, and we do that using anthropomorphic constraints. Okay, so, and you'll see that, watch the arm and see how naturally it moves. Okay, so now it's brain control. That little sign is up, that's brain control. See how nice the arm moves? Okay. We have a lot of problems besides the monkey. This arm is really hard to get to work. So far he hasn't gotten much better. Okay? He should get better, but it's not his fault. So that's a slow motion of the same thing. Okay. Rather than go on forever, I'll just show you. One thing that we plan to go to in the future is finger control, hand and finger control. So you can imagine this arm was only 4 degrees of freedom. The hand has 22 degrees of freedom. It's many orders of magnitude more difficult to control. This is an anthropomorphic finger, and the hand that you saw in the last one is going to be made at Carnegie Mellon. Colleague of mine, Yoki Matsuoka, is working on it. And it's going to have natural tendons and muscle insertions and joints, and of almost the same degrees of freedom as a natural finger. This is an index finger that's actually working now. Okay, and then this is the last slide.